31st from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Grand entry will be at 1 and 6 p.m. with honorings, Ed Goodell as the whip man, Nara All Nations Drum as the host drum, and MC Philip Archambault. Again, that's the Nara New Year's Eve Sobriety Powwow, Thursday, December 31st, from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center, Hall A and B, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Happy holidays, and welcome to a special edition of The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Today we'll be talking with Portland artist and filmmaker Mark Andres, whose newest animated silent film, The Somnambulists, will screen at the Northwest Film Center on January 6th of next year.
And we'll also be joined by documentarian Gina Liebrecht, who recently teamed up with Les Blank to film an intimate portrait of direct cinema pioneer Richard Leacock.
First, though, let's welcome back Hollywood Theater programmer Dan Halstead. Dan is getting ready to screen a much-anticipated film beginning tonight. Welcome back to the KBOO Studios and the Film Show, Dan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so let's talk about the film tonight. It's premiering in 70mm, and it's already sold out for the first few days.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's Quentin Tarantino's new movie, The Hateful Eight, which he shot on 70mm Ultra Panavision, which is a unique ultra-wide aspect ratio that hasn't been used since 1966. And they had to make brand new lenses for us to have, and we dialed everything in, so we'll have the biggest image that we've shown at the Hollywood Theater since it was a Cinerama theater in the 1960s.
So, you know, we did a Go Digital or Go Dark a series of shows a couple of years ago. And this is, we are back to honest to God film, a film with light projecting right through it for this screening.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. We show film all the time at the Hollywood. We really dedicate ourselves to showing 35mm on a regular basis. And we brought back 70mm at the beginning of this year. We did a huge fundraising campaign because we had to track down all the parts for our projector that had gone missing to show 70mm. And then piece by piece, we found all the parts from film collectors and technicians across the country. So we showed 2001 Space Odyssey back in March, which is a huge sold-out show. And then we've done a few screenings since then. And then now Tarantino has the brand new film that luckily will be the only theater in Portland that can show it.
And Quentin Tarantino name-checked you in a recent interview.
Yeah, he did. In the press conference, he said he mentioned us and a couple other movie palaces across the country where you can see the movie in the way he intended. And he actually personally requested that we open the film as well.
And you've got an anniversary coming up, speaking of 70mm.
You mean the 90th anniversary of the theater?
Didn't Hollywood Theater, well, this wasn't you, it's before your time, but didn't Hollywood Theater premiere its 70mm system on Christmas Day?
Yeah, that's right. Christmas Day 1959 is when 70 originally played there, so it's a return to form.
So what can people expect when they show up and they have a ticket? And they come in, and it's going to be a full immersive movie palace experience.
Yeah, I mean, it is a return to, they're calling it the roadshow experience, like what they called the 60s 70mm Ultra Panavision movies. So they made programs to hand out. There's an overture by Ennio Morricone at the beginning of the movie, which the music is incredible. There's an intermission, since it's a long film, which I always think movies over 2 hours need intermissions. And yeah, it's the movie looks incredible, and it's such a huge screen. It is the most immersive experience I think you can have watching a film in that format.
Now, I think KBU listeners have been following the Black Lives Matter movement and know that Quentin Tarantino has been a huge advocate and has gotten in trouble with some police unions who threatened to boycott the film. This film definitely deals with race on a very stark basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially, yeah, the first half of the film really is a study of racism in America, and it's set right after the Civil War. And a lot of it is just about how, even though the war is over, all those feelings and all that animosity is still there, and it still resonates today.
Well, Dan Halstead, Hollywood Theater, tell people how they can find out more about your nonprofit theater and about the 70mm programs and specifically The Hateful Eight.
Yeah, go to our website, hollywoodtheater.org. If you want to buy tickets to The Hateful Eight, I strongly recommend buying them in advance. Shows are selling out like crazy. And yeah, that's the best way to buy tickets.
Well, Dan, it's always a pleasure to have you back. Thanks for dropping in today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. We are live without a net on Christmas Eve. And let's go now to Jen Chavez and her guest.
My favorite way to do radio, folks. Well, The Somnambulists is a new animated silent film by Mark Andres, a painter and filmmaker in Portland who makes silent films using drawings, music, and intertitles. It'll be introduced by Mark at a special screening coming up at the Northwest Film Center on January 6th at 7 p.m. Mark Andres joins us now in studio to discuss his work. Mark, thank you for joining us and welcome to The Film Show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we absolutely love having you in this nice holiday show with Vince Guaraldi and everything. Feeling good. So, Mark, I'd love to start by fleshing out the type of work you've developed in the Portland film scene for the past several years with both features and shorts. I love all the stylistic intersections here. Your work falls under the self-describing moniker of kinographic novels. Can you explain what that means, how it represents the stylistic blend that you're working with?
Yeah, the term is a term that I came up with to describe that these films are going to look different than other films. They have still drawings, intertitles, and a full silent film score. So they have affinities to the old silent film format, but also to the graphic novel. So kinographic's an early adjective for silent film, you know, and it dovetails with the idea of the graphic novel.
Great. What are some of your favorite silent films or graphic novels?
Well, I grew up watching a lot of silent films. They used to run them on the local public television program. So I think those were really formative. I was a teenager and I saw a lot of Eisenstein and Fritz Lang. And those films, the films, the images that you're exposed to as a child embed themselves in your consciousness. And
absolutely,
I think silent films feel very, very pure in relation to the film form, and they also have given me a way to make movies on my own terms with drawing. So they're still images. They don't, and we call them animated films for lack of a better term, but they don't animate. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that when people experience them at screenings, I don't think this is a bad thing, by the way, they're completely quiet because they have to read. and there's a fair amount of reading. I mean, it's not long, but there's a kind of a communal concentration that I feel in the room that makes me very happy. That
they're enveloped
in something that isn't a naturalistic film, mm-hmm. and it's very low tech. I mean, the drawings aren't made on a tablet. They're made with paper and mm-hmm. pencils and other art materials, and there's eraser crumbs, and there's something very handmade, the exact opposite of 70mm.
That's okay. We're across the spectrum here today. This all sounds great, and your latest film is done in this style. It's called The Somnambulists. It premiered this year in Portland and also won Best Animated Film at the 2015 Independent Filmmakers Showcase. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I understand that it premiered earlier this year. looking at the film, I don't know if retrofuturist is really the right term, mm-hmm. but it's at once a throwback to early silent cinema, as you say, and a surrealistic, futuristic sci-fi mm-hmm. kind of tale. It's set in an underground city on the moon. Can you give us a window into the world you explore in this new film?
It's very much, as you describe, a kind of a mixture of contradictions, of very old and new. And I like the idea of, well, because I think about, you know, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, which is about the future, but also looks, it looks terrific, but it's mm-hmm. also old. And I love that look, the idea that the future is also past. And the look of the film is dark. The drawings are very expressionist. They're very stylized. It has a kind of a dreamlike quality. So it's like somebody's dream of the future rather than an actual future that we would experience.
Right, and dreaming is a big theme of the film, correct?
Yes, the sort of conceit of the film is there's a drug called Somnambula that allows people to live without sleep. So on the moon, there's an underground city, like an ant farm, mm-hmm. and the people are up all night long, all the time. And the workers are working triple shifts. And the idea is that they just keep working all the time so they can retire at 35. But they're just living a kind of a sleepwalking life on this drug where they don't have time to dream. And so their lives are kind of in a semi-conscious state. And the film, I think, creates a sort of a strange dreamlike feeling. At least that's the intent.
Yeah, like you're in a daze from lack of sleep.
Yes, and the main character is trying to wake up. That's his goal is to become conscious and to become awake, and that's his struggle because his own sort of dreamlike projections and experiences confuse him.
Great. Well, it sounds really fascinating. And, you know, I'm curious about, well, I'm glad you mentioned Fritz Lang's Metropolis because I noticed that as an influence. And also talking about it being a dark film kind of gives me a film noir type of impression, which I really love. I am curious about some cultural references in your artwork that I noticed from clips of the film. I noticed a kind of old school Arabian vibe on one hand, like snake charmers, mm-hmm. women with headscarves. And it reminded me a little bit of the book Habibi by Chuck Thompson. But not to mention also a kind of vintage French Moulin Rouge sort of feel. Can you talk about those choices, where that inspiration came from, making cultural references in a kind of imaginary city?
Yeah, it's very much an amalgam of things, and it's not a naturalistic film. Mm-hmm. And there is a different visual style. Like, I love the Persian miniature painting, and there's parts of the film that sort of go more linear that way. Other parts are very there's a French and a German expressionist film feeling.
Which makes sense with the silent film themes.
But I think the cultural references are very dreamlike in the way I use them, as if somebody's having a dream where these figures that are kind of, you could almost call them cultural stereotypes, are appearing, but they shift. Like avatars, and many of the characters go through a visual as well as there's one character goes through a gender change. So there's a sense of being in a liminal space where we're sort of moving in and out of various archetypes. So I think that's the best way I can explain it. There's also a kind of a The characters appear very different from frame to frame, but they're also clearly the same people.
Well, this just seems like something that you would find in a person's subconscious. You know,
yes.
These archetypes, shifting visual representations, shifting gender. Thank you for fleshing that out a little bit. You are a painter, and as you've mentioned, that there are still drawings that are the basis of this film. A lot of them for this film looked like charcoal. I don't know if that is accurate or not. if you could tell us a little bit about the artwork, and also about, I understand some of it is on exhibition right now in Portland.
Well, I am a painter. I've worked as a painter and an illustrator for most of my life. I started when I was very young, at 18. So I have strong ties to the world of illustration and also to fine art, because I'm a painter. I make a lot of landscape paintings. And my paintings went through a change about 10 years ago, where they became like little movies with panels or graphic novel pages. And I started making little movies just for my own sort of amusement of the paintings. And then that led logically to making movies. So these are actually, the ones in the film are drawn on, they're 5x7-inch drawings. If you go down to Augen, which is my gallery, they're surprisingly small, considering the way they look on a big screen. And I love the fact, we showed it down in Los Angeles at the Beverly Hills Music Hall on Wilshire Boulevard. It was a huge screen, and I was a little nervous that these little tiny drawings that are like the size of a postcard were going to, they looked fantastic. They looked amazing at that scale, and I love the look of a drawing on a big screen. I think there's something about that that's different than a photograph or a film photograph, and it can do things that film can't do, I think, and that's what intrigues me about this form.
Great. Well, I just want to let people know, if they're interested in seeing this exhibition, the Augen Gallery is located at 716 Northwest Davis Street. Thank you very much for coming down today. Just one more time, let me make sure I have it right. The Northwest Film Center is screening this on Wednesday, January 6th at 7 p.m.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right.
Fantastic. Well, folks, today I've been speaking with Mark Andres, the Portland filmmaker behind the new silent film / graphic novel, The Somnambulists. Mark, many thanks for coming in today to speak with us on KBOO.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Now back to Conch, who's joined now by filmmaker Gina Leibret to discuss her newest documentary film, How to Smell a Rose.
Thanks, Jen. Yes, we have Gina Leibret on the line. She was recently at the Hollywood Theater with her film, How to Smell a Rose, which was directed with the late Les Blank. Gina, welcome to the film show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks for coming on board. We want to ask you about this film now. It's a really intense film. Les Blank, who was your filmmaking partner, you went to visit Richard Leacock, who is this amazing filmmaker. He's just part of the history of modern film. And this film is now available. It's coming up on DVD. It's been screening in festivals. It's been around the country. It's on Fandor. Tell us about How to Smell a Rose.
Well, back in 2000, Les and I went and visited Ricky Leacock at his farm in Normandy for 4 or 5 days and just recorded him telling stories about his filmmaking experiences. He actually lived through several eras of filmmaking and was an instigator in the American Cinema Verite movement. So we just recorded conversations with him and filmed him cooking. He was a fabulous cook.
Yeah, those are great scenes.
And yeah.
Well, the American Cinema Verite movement is often called direct cinema, and famous filmmakers from that era include D.A. Pennybaker and Albert Maysles, who directed the documentaries Gimme Shelter and Grey Gardens. And we've been privileged to have Albert on the show, the late Albert Maysles now. He was interviewed by KBOO's own Kate Welch. But Richard Leacock was instrumental in creating the portable camera equipment that made direct cinema possible, and which has, you know, now become a staple of documentary production.
Absolutely. I mean, it revolutionized filmmaking, because before, they were tied down by really heavy equipment. They had to be on a tripod. There had to be a cable connected to a sound person, and you could, there were handheld cameras, but there was no sync sound. So what they did was that they invented handheld cameras that had synchronous sound, and it completely liberated them, and they could move around with their subjects and record dialogue and record things as they were really happening.
Yes, in the 60s, there was an incredible intimacy that you got with a lot of politicians. These filmmakers, it sort of took them off guard because they didn't have to set up a tripod. They would just get in close and they would get all these people unguarded, which would never happen nowadays.
I know people are much more media savvy now than they used to be. And so back then, you know, they could just install themselves in certain situations and literally just kind of disappear. And people would forget that they were in the room filming. I mean, there's an art to that in itself, you know, being able to disappear.
Now, one of the great documentary filmmakers was your collaborator, Les Blank, who we're sorry to have lost, because here in Portland, his screenings have always been very popular at independent theaters around town. He, you know, not just his portraits are not just intimate, but they're funny.
Right. Well, he took cinema verite and he sort of took it to the next step. He was just slightly younger than these masters of cinema verite. So what Les did was he used a lot of their techniques to film his subjects, but then in the editing room, he really took it to another level by combining music and images and creating something completely new and different. The cinema verite filmmakers would never have used music the way Les did, and they would never have done, you know, poetic imagery. They just wanted to record things the way that they happened.
Generally without a narrator.
And preferably without a narrator, which often they were not able to pull off. It's actually a very difficult thing to do, to make a film with no narration. None of Les's films have narration except for Burden of Dreams.
The portrait of the great German filmmaker Werner Herzog.
That's right. He had to use a narrator for that film because PBS wouldn't air it without a narrator. See, they wanted a certain kind of formula. They wanted something predictable, and they didn't believe that audiences could follow a film that didn't have narration.
So you are now one of the keepers of Les Blank's legacy, and you're actually working on a documentary about Les's career and life with his son.
I am. I actually started filming Les right at the same time that we were filming Ricky Leacock back in 2000. And I've been filming him over the course of about 15 years. And after he died, I asked his son, Herod, to collaborate with me. So we've been working together the last couple of years. And basically in the film, I'm really looking at the way that Les developed his unique cinematic vision and all the things that happened in his life that led to those things. So, literally, you know, answering the question, how did Les Blank become Les Blank?
So you were also instrumental in getting Les. Les doesn't like to be on camera, but you wanted to show that intimacy between him and Richard Leacock in the film How to Smell a Rose, and that really becomes very touching.
Yeah, originally Les was making the film the way he made his other films, which was to be kind of hidden behind the camera. And when I was there with them, afterwards I realized, you know, really the magic was in this interaction between the two of them. And so as I was editing the film, I approached Les about the idea of including him more in the film. And he really was not open to the idea. And so I dropped it. And then shortly before he died, I brought it up again. And he seemed more open to it. And so we did just this one last interview with him, which is at the beginning of the film. And it was literally, you know, 2 weeks before he died, where we got him talking about his relationship with Ricky and why he was so interested in making this film.
Well, how can people keep up with the progress on this film that you're doing about Les Blank and about the collaboration that you did with him before he died, which is How to Smell a Rose?
Well, I have a website, GinaLebrecht.com, and I have a mailing list, and I send out very occasional emails, like quarterly, giving updates on the film. And I think that's probably, you know, Facebook also is a good way. I occasionally post things on Facebook about the film on Les. As far as How to Smell a Rose, it's available on most of the streaming portals, and in January it will be available on Netflix, and I believe the DVD is coming out in January. And I'm still doing occasional theatrical screenings, like one-offs like we did at the Hollywood.
Well, we know that you used to be a Portland native. You're based in the Bay Area now and traveling around, but we certainly hope to see you back in Portland next chance you get.
Absolutely.
Gina Labreck, thank you so much for joining us. The film is How to Smell a Rose, and we hope that you'll come back and join us again soon.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
And you're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and I'm here with Jen Chavez. We're live in the studio on Christmas Eve, and Jen has some film events to tell you about.
I sure do. Happy holidays once again. And here are a few film events coming up in the next month that may be of interest. Running today through Sunday the 27th, the Clinton Street Theater continues its years-long Portland Christmas tradition, The Big Lebowski, screenings every night at 7:30, and featuring the Clinton Street's own blend of rice Russians, The Dude Abides. More info at cstpdx.com. The Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival continues its monthly feminist screening series at the Clinton Street Theater, POW Monthly, with December and January screenings. On Monday the 28th, that's December, at 7 p.m., they'll present Young Lakota, a documentary following young people on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation and the fight for reproductive rights in the form of a proposed women's health clinic. And on January 25th at 7 p.m., they'll kick off 2016 with a screening of LunaFest, a traveling festival of award-winning short films by, for, and about women. The series will continue every fourth Monday. Details are available at cstpdx.com. On January 7th through the 9th, the Northwest Film Center and Portland dance company Bodyvox will partner to present the first annual Contact Film Festival. With screenings at the Film Center and Bodyvox's studio in Northwest Portland, the showcase will feature award-winning collaborations between filmmakers, dancers, and choreographers from around the world. Details can be found at nwfilm.org and bodyvox.com. On January 9th at noon, the Northwest Film Center kicks off its series From Bombay to Bollywood, 50 Years of Indian Cinema, with the film Awara on 35mm. This classic 1951 Bollywood romance was directed by and also stars Atur Raj Kapoor. Following the film, a reception will feature refreshments and musics by KBOO's DJ Anjali and The Incredible Kid. More info on that series available at nwfilm.org. Kicking off on January 15th and running through early February at the Northwest Film Center, the 33rd annual Real Music Film Festival, celebrating the crossovers of sound, music, and image with screenings of an eclectic mix of music documentaries and performance films. Four of the festival's films are being sponsored by us here at KBOO. Details are available at nwfilm.org. And folks, that about wraps it up for our film calendar this month. I hope you enjoy and have a lovely holiday.
Yes, you've been listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser. Thanks to our guests today, Mark Andres, Gina Labrecht, and Dan Halstead. And thanks as always to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web.
Yes, thank you, thank you, thank you. The audio for the show will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter as well at KBOO Film Show.
Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Thursday, December 24th, 2015. I'm John Schock. Both sides are claiming a victory in Northeast Portland's low-income housing dispute. The dispute concerns the Ellington, a 264-unit apartment complex in Northeast Portland's Rose City neighborhood. Owners of the property, Guardian Real Estate Services, settled on a compromise with the Oregon Law Center, who had been advocating for the low-income tenants. Instead of seeking to make all 264 units affordable for 5 years, the Oregon Law Center negotiated for an equivalent deal that preserves 44 units for 30 years. According to the compromise, most of the 184 apartments currently rented by low-income residents will be lost over the next 5 years. Many are expected to move out through normal turnover, but